Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
It is my pleasure to welcome you to Central Library and to tonight's program with Julia Quinn. I wanted to take a minute to thank all of the people who made tonight's program possible. We are so grateful to our author series sponsors, Gary Kunis and the Seattle Times, and we're also grateful to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Private gifts to the foundation from thousands of donors help the library provide free programs and services that touch the lives of everyone in our community. So if any of you are library donors, Library Foundation donors, thank you so much for your support. Now it is my pleasure to introduce Julia Quinn. Yeah, we're excited. Tonight, she is here to celebrate the launch of her most recent book, The Girl with a Make-Believe Husband, which is part of the Ropesby series, which I believe is a prequel to the Bridgertons. Is that accurate? Yes? Okay. Julia is a New York Times bestselling writer and is one of only 16 authors ever to be inducted into the Romance Writers of America Hall of Fame. She's the author of 25 novels, including her very popular Bridgerton series, the Bevelstoke series. Ooh, and I forgot to ask, is it the Smith-Smith Quartet or the Smythe-Smith Quartet? So without further ado, please help me welcome Julia Quinn.
So I'm not Susan Burton. Anyway, so thank you all so much for coming, especially because it's so nice outside and we're inside, and that's, I think, really hard for Seattleites to do when the weather actually turns nice. But I thought I would start out by chatting a little bit with you about a few things that I've learned as a romance writer. People often ask about my career. And the main thing I have realized is that most people who ask about my career and what I do don't actually know what a romance novel is. And people think they know. And people really think they know now that 50 Shades of Grey has become really popular. But that's actually not considered a romance novel in terms of the way publishing thinks of a romance novel. So I'm going to explain that. It used to be way back when that a romance novel consisted of a man and a woman, and now we're much broader. You can have man-man, woman-woman. I've seen woman-dragon, hedgehog shapeshifters, all sorts of things. I'm pretty vanilla with this. Mine couples tend to be hetero. Well, I mean, they are hetero, but you can do, basically you need two people meeting or re-meeting at the beginning of the book, and it has to have a happy ever after at the end. And for romance fiction, that happy ever after means, you know, a commitment, a long-term commitment to the other person. Since I write historical romance, that generally means marriage or, you know, the intention of marriage. How you get from the beginning to the end is completely open. And I think a lot of people tend to think that a romance novels follow a formula. I've had people say, so, does your publisher just send you a plot and you do it? And I'm like, no, I write my books all by myself. I come up with the whole thing. I really don't get questions like that often. But I try to explain to people when they think of the word formula, and I said, you know, it's not a formula, but there are parameters. And if you think about it, with a mystery, you need to open with somebody getting killed or a dead body being found, right? And you need to end it with the murder being solved. And how you get from the beginning to the end is a wide open canvas, just the same as in romance where you have to have two people meet or re-meet and have a happily ever after. And with any type of genre fiction, reader expectation really plays into it. And if you think about it, imagine if you're reading an Agatha Christie novel and at the end, you know, Miss Marple or Hercule Poirot was just like, that's a stumper. You know, you'd be really upset. And it's the same thing with romance. We need to have that happy ever after. If there isn't a happy ever after, no matter how romantic the book was, it's not a romance novel. And I do make kind of a joke, and it's a little bit snide, but it's also kind of true that when a man tries to write a romance novel, in general, the woman dies. Which is why, you know, you'll read something about Nicholas Sparks, and he'll say, I don't write romance novels, and he's right. He doesn't write romance novels because he just, you know, he keeps killing off these women. Or, like, Love Story, you know, she dies in the end. That's not a romance novel. So that's what a romance novel is. And then also, another key difference is the difference between romance novels and erotica. And that's something that's really come into play recently, people with Fifty Shades of Grey and stuff like that. And the way to look at it is that in romance novels, the emotion and the emotional journey are the most important part. And if there are intimate scenes, you know, in a good romance novel, they are there to move forward the plot and the characterization. Whereas in erotica, the main point of the book are the intimate scenes and the emotions arising around that. And then the last thing I was going to say about what a romance novel is that the romance needs to be the main part of the story. So if you have a book where, you know, this, you've got this main female character and she's the heroine and she's falling in love with this guy and at the same time she's dealing with this big, you know, some sort of family issue, dealing with her mom's chemotherapy or something. Well, which of those two stories is the big part of the book? If it's the romantic part, then you probably have a romance novel. If it's really her dealing with her family issues and, you know, abandonment of her, you know, from her father, when you, all that stuff, then it's called women's fiction. So it kind of depends on what the main focus of the book is. So that's what a romance novel is. Now, moving on, and I'm also happy to take questions while I'm chatting. Okay, yeah. So he asked me, is Romeo and Juliet qualify as a romance? No. I personally don't even find it romantic, but because it's not a happy ending. I mean, you know, in all honesty, it's a story about two really spoiled teenagers. It's a great story about two really spoiled teenagers, but it wouldn't be. And plus, when I talk about what a romance novel is, it's in the modern terms for the genre. And, you know, Shakespeare was writing hundreds and hundreds of years ago, so I think it's hard to try to label him in the same way. Yes. So she was asking if I ever get frustrated by the way books are often shelved in bookstores. I think, if I'm getting this right, that you find that a lot of books that you wouldn't consider to be romance novels get shelved in the romance section, maybe because... That, and they don't necessarily follow my parameters. I think the person to be probably the most frustrated would be the author of those books because her books probably aren't in quite the right spot. It's tricky. Excuse me. And there are a number of authors who started out writing romance and aren't really writing romance anymore. I mean, a lot of, for example, what Nora Roberts does now would not be strictly considered romance novels, but because she's written, 8,000 other romance novels... You know, people know to look for her there, so it's a little bit tricky. And I think bookstores are always trying to figure out the best way to do this. I mean, they want people to find the books that they want to read, so it can be tough. For me, it works out pretty well because I'm writing squarely within the genre, so there's no other place anybody's going to put my books, and there's no other place they really belong, so that's nice. But I'm going to move on a little bit and talk about another thing I've learned about being an author, and this one isn't specific to romance writing, and it's actually not even specific to writing, but these days everyone seems to have a home office, and so I'm going to give you like a really critical piece of advice, and that's when you set up your workspace, make absolutely sure that you cannot reach your refrigerator without getting up from your chair, okay? You can laugh, but actually my husband's here tonight, and he will remember our first apartment together in Berkeley. You can wave. Sorry. So our very first apartment, we did what any like really poor recent college grads would do. We moved to the Bay Area, and we had this really small apartment, and he usually goes to bed before I do, so he put his desk in the bedroom, and the only other place left for me was this kind of desk-height counter in the kitchen, which was like right here, and the fridge was like right here, and I'm on a rolling chair, so I'm just like, so I would just say, yeah, avoid that. That's not a good thing. So here's another interesting thing I've learned. Nobody seems to think you're a real writer unless they've seen your book at the supermarket. I don't fully understand why this is so, but like I've had friends kind of wince and give me this look like they think maybe my career's about to fall apart because they were at Safeway and they didn't see my book and like clearly like everything's like, you know, going into a handbasket there. And I'm like, then I explain, no, it's okay. You know, Safeway only has, you know, 40 books at a time, and so they only have the new ones. But here's the thing, it's actually really fun when you do see your book at the supermarket. And although I should point out that you will never see your book at your supermarket. There's some kind of weird law of physics, and I don't really understand it, but once you like do all your computations and boil it down, it says that no matter how successful you are, how many books you've written, I think even if you get a moving deal, your book will never show up at the supermarket or drugstore at which you do your regular shopping. It just won't. What? No, she's saying it's probably a good thing. No, it's not a good thing. I want my book in my supermarket, and I also want my book. I'm going to talk to you over there. I would love to see my book at my local branch of the Seattle Public Library. Yeah, it turns out you can't donate books to the Seattle Public Library, because I've tried. I've gone in and be like, you want my book? And they give me this look like, you're really scaring us. And I'm like, but I live around the corner, and don't you want to have my book on the shelf? And they're like, we can't accept donations. And I'm like, but you promise it's a real book. But anyway, for me, though, kind of the most fun moment of seeing your book out, we call it, like, authors were like, seeing your book out in the wild. This wasn't even really seeing it, but when my very first book came out, it was 1995, and do you guys all remember Walden Books? It's kind of, yeah, it's kind of sad. But anyway, Walden Books was still around then, and my local Walden Books called me, and they're just like, we got your book in, and we sold 9. And that was when I realized that 9 people who aren't related to me had bought my book. And that was the best. But I'll just be honest. Even I've been published now for over 2 decades, and I've had lots of books out, and it's still always really, really exciting to see your book out there in the wild. I promise you, pretty much every author in existence, like, they cannot wander through a library bookstore without, like, sort of taking a little detour. Just, I'm just going to peek and see if my book's on the shelf, and then, you know. And then they get back there, and they're like, I'm just going to rearrange things just a little bit so my book is face out. So we do that, too. Our parents also do it. I've had to warn my dad off because, like, he gets back there, and he starts rearranging the whole thing, and then he starts trying to recommend my books to people, and I'm like, Dad, you kind of look like the creepy old man in the romance section. He's like, I'm okay with that. I'm like, I'm not Dad. It's like, or the other thing I always do, another author confession for you. So I travel a lot. I mean, I'm gold on Alaska, and so I can tell you after all my flights, every time we're walking down to like go to the back of the plane to go to the lab, when we come back, we're always looking to see what you're reading. Always. It's gotten much harder now that people have ebooks, but I can report that in my many years of flying, I have never seen someone reading one of my books on an airplane. But there is not a plane in the sky that does not have somebody reading a Nora Roberts book. Every freaking time. And I told her that once. I've met her several times. She's, like, amazing. I think she runs on, like, Diet Pepsi and cigarettes, and she has the most incredible work ethic. And so I told her once, I'm like, you know, there's somebody's always reading your plane, and she was just like, that's great. So, and then finally, the other thing I would tell you that I've really learned is that writing, you know, it is a solitary pursuit, but being an author gives you this entree into this amazing world, this community of readers and books, and I know that there are a lot of authors who, they'll say, look, I would write no matter what. You know, if nobody was reading my books, I would still write because I have to write. And I'll be the first one to say, I don't have to write. In fact, there are a lot of things I'd rather do than write. I really like having written. That's really great. I really like being a writer, but I'm lazy. I like to do other things, too. And I don't think I would write if I didn't think people were going to be reading my stories. To me, that's just a really integral part of the whole thing. I mean, it's, you know, it's a big old circle, and I don't want to write into a vacuum. And so this whole new world, well, not new anymore, but when I first started writing, the internet was still really, really small. And now, you know, we get feedback from everywhere about our books, and there are a lot of authors who hate that, but I actually like it. I like to know how people are receiving my books. And for the most part, when I see somebody say something critical, there's usually something in there where I can be like, you know, I might say, well, you could have said that a little more nicely. But at the same time, like, there's usually some sort of kernel of truth. Like, they'll say, I really didn't like the way she did this. And I'd be like, you know, I knew when I did that some people wouldn't like that. Or, you know, I knew that wasn't the strongest part, but I did the best I could. And that's, you know, I just keep trying to do the best I can with each book. But on the flip side, hearing from readers about your books, well, it can be interesting. So early on in my career, this is back, I don't actually have an email link on my website anymore because I decided I would rather not receive reader mail than not answer it. And I wasn't able to keep up with it. So now I have a Facebook page, which you should all like, because I'm terrible at Twitter, but I'm really good at Facebook. And so people can leave me comments there. But back when I was getting emails from readers, I got one, and this is my all-time favorite. This woman writes to me, it's like, you would be a really good writer if you would use more nouns, verbs, and adjectives. And I remember staring at my computer screen for the longest time thinking, I must be, like, the most amazing writer ever if I can write an entire novel in adverbs and prepositions. It's, you know, like, and you read it! So, and then another one is that readers will start catching every mistake you make. And you do make mistakes. If you've read the new book, yeah, I know about the typo. I promise, we're trying to fix it. but what's really kind of funny, and I've decided I'm going to take this as a compliment, is that when I do hear from readers now about mistakes in my books, I would say at least 90% of the time now, it's a mistake I've made against my own fictional world. So it's not like I got something wrong in real history. It's like I got something wrong in, like, my fictional history. And my favorite example of this is a little while ago I wrote a book. It came up there a while ago. It was called Just Like Heaven. And often I like to put little Easter eggs in the books for the readers. You know, people who've read a lot of the books, so they can be like, oh, I know who she's talking about. You know, and the new reader would have no clue, and it's fine. So I was doing this, writing the scene, and I was thinking how we all do this thing where, you know, we're trying to explain to somebody who someone is, and we're just like, oh, you know, it's you know, her aunts, neighbors, friends, brothers, you know, that sort of thing. So I thought, well, of course people did that 200 years ago, right? So I put that in there, and it was clear if you'd read my earlier books who I was talking about. Now, if you hadn't read my earlier books, it just was kind of this fun little joke about me talking, you know, people being like, oh, you know, the aunts, whatever. Well, in order for that to be correct, that you knew who was talking about, the guy would have had to have been married, right? And then later in the book, I had him, like, as a bit character, and he was single. So I didn't catch this. My editor didn't catch this. My copy editor didn't catch this. My sister who read it didn't catch it. And I have to defend myself by saying that if you hadn't read my earlier books, there's nothing within the boundaries of this one novel that's incorrect. But I heard from readers about this 3 hours after the book went on sale. Yeah, and that book came out a while ago, and I'm still hearing from readers about that. And so I've just decided that's a good thing. Like, if my readers are that invested in my fictional world that they're going to notice that, I think that's awesome. And then finally, I wanted to share with you, you know, speaking of the interaction with readers and knowing how your work affects others, every now and then you hear from a reader and it kind of stops you in your tracks, and you realize that even if you're not saving the world from Ebola, although I actually do have a friend who's a romance author who is saving the world from Ebola, her day job is at the CDC, so you should all read books by Jennifer McQuiston because we should support her. But I'm not saving the world from Ebola. But I think I'm still doing something pretty important, and I'm going to read you a letter that sort of showed me that hopefully that's true. So it says, Dear Ms. Quinn, this is an old one, but I want to thank you for the enjoyment you bring to your readers. I'm a 23-year-old wife of almost 6 years and a mother of a 5-year-old. The first book of yours I read was How to Marry a Marquis, and I was instantly ensnared in the historical romance genre. And soon after, I bought all your books. My mother was a strict Stephen King fan or fan of suspense novels, and she told me that romance books were sappy. I convinced her to read The Duke and I, and she quickly turned to the Viscount who loved me. She was constantly telling me to hurry up and finish a book so she could read it. On Valentine's Day of 2001, my mom was diagnosed with lung cancer. Each chemo treatment was anywhere from 2 to 6 hours long. I was what they call a caregiver for my mother. I was at every doctor's appointment, every chemo and radiation treatment with my mom, so you can imagine how much reading we did during treatments. They had these ugly blue leather recliners for us to sit in during chemo, and I remember the day that an offer from a gentleman came out. She insisted that we stop and get it before heading to the chemo center. I was sitting there already on page 50, 45 minutes into the treatment, and I hear this really loud sound that sounded like my mother had tooted. I looked over at her, and she looked quickly away from me. I was not about to embarrass her by bringing it to her attention, but 10 minutes later, I heard the same sound, and I looked over again, and my mom was trying extremely hard not to laugh. I asked what was so funny, and she said nothing. So I went back to reading, and I hear it again not 5 minutes later, and I looked at my mom and said, "Mom, do you need me to get a nurse to unhook you so you can go to the bathroom?" She just busted out laughing, and I said, "I swear it wasn't me." I looked around our little cubicle and back at her as if to say, "We're alone. Who else could it be?" She sat back in her chair and then leaned toward me again, and there was that sound. She laughed again and said, "I've been trying to read over your shoulder, but every time I lean toward you, the chair sounds like I farted." There were quite a few hospital visits that consisted of 12-hour days and then coming home to my son and husband. When Romancing Mr. Bridgerton came out, I passed it to my mom after reading it, and soon after, she was back in the hospital. 3 days later, my mom died on August 3rd, 2002. Her name was Donna Dudley, and she was 39 years old. She would have turned 40 on December 22nd. She'd been trying to finish the book because she knew her time was short. She didn't get to, and I had forgotten all about it until I unpacked her bag from the hospital, and I noticed it wasn't there. I had to go back to that room to get it. That was hard, but I finished reading it to her at her gravesite. My point in all this is that while we were already best friends, and while the illness brought us closer, sharing a common interest in books gave us just that much more to talk and laugh about. Thank you. So it's things like that, I think, that teach me the most about my own career as a writer and what I do matters and is important. That I can open up someone's mind and heart that way. So, thank you. And if we have time, I'm happy to read or just start. Where is Stesha? Oh! So, if you'd like, I can either take questions or I can read from the book or. Yes, sorry. So, the question is, where do I basically do my historical research? Primarily online now. Obviously, it's much easier now with the internet, although you have to be very careful about using your sources on the internet. Wikipedia is not a reliable source. I have librarians here in the audience. They could tell you that. I kind of joke that when I research my books, I have very broad and shallow knowledge of the period, meaning that there are a lot of things I don't have to look up. I don't have to look up how you address a duke. I don't have to look up a lot of the social customs. And so when I'm starting a book, I generally don't need to do a lot of research when I get started, and I tend to look things up as I go along. And it's the strangest things that you end up looking up. For example, I was writing a book a while back, and somebody made a joke about Little Bo Peep, and I remember I was writing along, and usually I don't laugh at my own jokes when I'm writing, but this time I did, and something I'm like, I'm so funny. And then I thought, oh my gosh, what's the earliest known reference of Little Bo Peep, right? I don't know. And it turns out it's Shakespeare, so I was okay. But there have been plenty of other times where I've done something and then thought, oh my gosh, what's the earliest known reference of such and such, and discovered that actually I can't use that. Well, I guess my least favorite example, because I really wanted to use it, is the pen is mightier than the sword, which I assumed was Shakespeare. Tis not. Maybe the only thing that sounds like that that's not Shakespeare, it's actually Edward Bulwer Lytton, who is famous for having written the worst opening line in the history of novels, "It was a dark and stormy night." In fact, there's now an entire contest named for Edward Bulwer Lytton to write the opening line with the worst novel ever written. I highly encourage you all to look in the Bulwer Lytton contest every year. It's really funny, but he did do The Pen is Mightier Than the Sword, so he kind of did the best and the worst. So the question is just, how do I keep all the characters straight? Because, so I've written 25 novels and some novellas and stuff like that, and not all the books, but many of them, you know, these characters inhabit the same world, and so I'll often, you know, if I have to say, oh, so-and-so danced with someone at this party, I'll often bring in the name of a character that I've used in another book because it's fun for readers, and it's also one fewer name that I have to make up. And I'll tell you, you realize that there's only, your brain works in like really specific ways, because I have, you know, I have this character named Lady Whistledown who's a gossip columnist, and I thought, oh, this is a great name, so I used it, and like four books into it, someone's like, you know, you had like, you know, a Mr. Whistledown in another book, and I was like, I did? You know, I had no idea I did that. So it's tough. I would say you should, many authors do what they call have a Bible, where they try to keep track of everything, and I have a few documents. I'm not the best at that, mainly because a lot of times when I write series, I don't necessarily intend to write a long series. The Bridgerton series, which had 8 books in it, was originally supposed to be 3. If I had known I was going to write an 8-book series, I probably would have been a little bit more organized about it at the beginning. There are a couple of times I really wrote myself into a corner and was kind of like, oh, gosh, what am I going to do? Like, I realized I was going to have 3 books in a row with, like, 28-year-old spinsters as the heroines, and I thought, well, I can't have 3 in a row, right? What am I going to do? So I, 3 books into the series, I just said one of them had been widowed, and I didn't say anything. And then, of course, I get to that book and thought, oh, my gosh, now I have to figure out why she's a widow. And truly, this is how so many things happen. Like, people have asked me, so I should talk a little bit about this book since this is why I'm here, but The Girl with the Make-Believe Husband takes place in colonial-era New York, which was very new for me and involved quite a bit more research. And people say, well, why did you do that? Is it because of Hamilton? And I was like, no, I can't get tickets to Hamilton. I mean, can you? It would be nice. If any of you know how, let me know. No, it's because in the book before this, the hero's younger brother, who's an army captain, goes missing in the colonies because, it's set in 1779, so that's where the British army is, and it kind of ended that way, and I was like, ugh, all right, so he's over there, and now I can either, start the book there or can be, move it forward by, 5 years and be like, oh, everything worked out, and we're here. And I thought, okay, that seems like the easy way out. So I started the book in New York, and I kind of intended for them to move back to England, but they never actually made it. It didn't work out that way. But the point is, a lot of things that authors do come about because we have written ourselves into corners and have to desperately find our way out. Yeah. Okay, so she said she's here with her best friend, which I think is awesome that you're sharing books that way. And she was wondering if sometimes I talk about my characters as if they're real people and people look at me weird. People do look at me weird a lot, but not usually because of that. I have many other things I do that make people look at me strange. I don't do that with my characters. I'm an author, and it's kind of not a very romantic thing to say, because I think people think of authors as like living and breathing their characters, but I really turn it off. I finish writing and I'm like, let's go watch The Walking Dead, which is the new thing. I'm totally hooked on that right now. And don't tell me anything, because I'm only in season 2. But yeah, I don't, like, if I'm in something like this where, it's about books or I'm in a book conference or something, then yeah, of course I'm doing that. But in everyday life, they kind of, so no, sorry. But I do plenty of other weird things, I promise. Yes, right there. So the question is, what made me get into historical romance, and I've ever thought about branching out other genres? I started writing historical romance because it was what I like to read. I mean, it was as simple as that. And in fact, any writer I know, if you ask them, why did you become a writer? It's because they like to read. Have I thought about branching out? Yes, but only if I came up with a really good idea, and I don't really think I have. I mean, I have enough trouble coming up with good ideas for my historical romance, frankly. I have a lot of friends who have like 40 books plotted out in their head, and I'm always amazed. I am not that person. I get done with one, and I'm like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with the next book? I mean, you want to hear a secret? So this book, this is not a spoiler, but at the very end of the book, here, I'll read from it. I'm going to read from the last page. Okay, so they get together in the end. That's, you know, I hope that doesn't... I don't think that really gives anything away, that, like, at the end of the book, they're, like, in love. Okay. So, anyway, they've gone back to England, and she's meeting his family for the first time, and let's see. I'm trying to think where to start here. So, anyway, basically, they're asking about it. Okay, so Edward smiled broadly. Oh, mother and father in the village, George said. They should be back within the hour. So, this is, George is the older brother of the hero of this book, and he's the hero of the previous book. Edward smiled broadly. Excellent. And the rest? Nicholas is at school, Billy said. And of course, Mary has her own home now. And Andrew? Andrew, the third brother. Edward had told Cecilia that he was in the Navy. Is he here? Edward asked. George made a sound that Cecilia could not interpret. One might have called it a chuckle if it weren't so liberally laced with something better described as awkward resignation. Shall you tell him or shall I? Billy said. George took a breath. Well, now that is quite a story. Okay, so, like, obviously, like, right, next book about Andrew. Do you think I have a clue what that story is? No. I don't know. I was like, I needed to end the book, and I was like, all right, here's a hook. I kind of did this with this one, too. So, that's me saying, like, I don't have that many ideas. I finish the book and be like, okay, I'm going to end it this way to force me to come up with a clever idea. So, I think... I'm not a super fast writer, and I still really enjoy what I'm doing now, and I'm getting paid pretty nicely for it, and so I figure that as long as I'm enjoying it and I'm making a living, it doesn't make sense to change it up. And if I were faster and I could write like something in addition to what I'm doing, I might try something new, but if I were to try something new, it would have to be instead of, and I'm not really ready to do that. Yeah. Okay, so... The question is, which romance writers inspired me when I was starting out? Well, I read a lot of Amanda Quick, and she lives right here in Seattle, and so that's great. I read a lot of Julie Garwood, Judith McNaught, Lisa Kleypas, who's also a Washington romance writer now. She lives in Bellingham. There are a lot of romance authors in Washington State. Joanna Lindsay, Jude Devereaux, all the really great romance authors, their names begin with J, so I was like, I was born for this. Yes. So the question, the first part of the question is how long does it take me to write a book? And I would say about 6 to 9 months. And that includes the whole process of trying to figure out what the heck I'm going to write about. Like I'm putting together a proposal, which isn't really like an outline. It's sort of like a summary, and I do a lot of characterization. And that takes a lot longer than I feel like it ever should. So that's about 6 to 9 months. The second part was... do I start the next one before the process of the previous one is over? Like maybe like I finish up the manuscript and like now it's time to go into edits and I start the next one. No, it'd be great if I did. I'd be much faster, but I just, you know, I'm just so excited when I'm done. I'm like, oh, you know, I'm taking a break and I'm only going to take a break for 2 weeks and then like, you know, the whole summer goes by and I'm like, oof. I will say, getting back to Nora Roberts, who, you know, the woman with incredible work ethic, she finishes a book and takes 3 days off and starts another book. I know. I think I want to be her later, but yes, up there. Of my own? So the question is, do I have a favorite book or character of my own? I don't have a favorite book. That's kind of like asking me to pick a favorite kid, and I'm not going to do that because they're both here, so... but you can come up to me later. No. In terms of a favorite character, what's interesting is the characters I think who've come to mean the most to me are the ones who are not necessarily my heroes or heroines, but some secondary characters who I've been able to watch through many, many books. Violet Bridgerton, who is the mother of the Bridgertons, the people who are main characters, they're really in one book and maybe show up a little in another one, but Violet was in 8 books, so I actually spent a lot more time with her than any of the main heroes and heroines. And if you start at the beginning of the series, she's kind of a little bit of a stock character. But as the series went on and I got to know her, she really became a lot deeper. And then also Lady Danbury, who is this, you know, crotchety old lady who's been in a bunch of different books. And you know, I almost killed her off once. I know. It was going to be like this big dramatic moment in the book. Oh, she's patting her like, no, don't worry. No, she will never die. I'm saying that now because it's too much fun to write her. And I mean, I feel like she was, what? She would shake her cane at you. I mean, this is the woman who like managed to break someone's violin with a cane once. Like, it was an accident. So she's also become a big favorite as well. Three more questions, okay. Is there anybody who hasn't asked a question yet who would like to? Yes. So the question was, how did it feel going from writing in the time period of the early 1800s, which almost all my books have been, to the late 1700s, which my last two books have been? You know, not that different at first. You know, I had to sort of look up the clothing a little more, I'm not one of the writers who spends a lot of time describing clothing, but I sort of felt like I had to still get it right, so doing bits of research. The bigger shock to the system was moving from England to America, and a big part of that was because I actually grew up near New York, and so I had to make sure that I was using, you know, historical information and not my contemporary knowledge of the area. So that was a bigger thing, doing research on, you know, what was going on in New York at the time. What does it mean to be in an occupied city? Because you know, at the time, in 1779, when this book takes place, New York City is occupied by the British. So pretty much all the characters are British. And that was another crazy thing, to be writing a book set during Revolutionary War time in the United States, but where your main characters are British. So the good guys are British. Well, we're always taught, you know, they're the bad guys. So now I have to make them good guys without making the enemy the bad guys, because I don't want, like, the Americans to be the bad guys, right? So it was kind of tricky to figure out how to balance all of that. Wait, people who haven't asked a question. Right there. So the question is, have I ever been writing and realized that one of my characters was inspired by somebody I don't particularly like? And if so, what happens? No, but this seems to be a bigger issue for mystery writers. And I will tell you, I did this talk once, and it was the most bizarre set of authors ever. It was for Borders Books was having like this meeting where for all their assistant regional managers or something, and they brought in some authors to speak, and it was me, this guy who'd written this, I can't remember his name, he'd written this nonfiction book about the Nazi submarine that was found off the coast of New Jersey. Diane Mott Davidson, who writes cozy mysteries, you know, like Double Shot, I don't know, whatever. And Chuck Palahniuk, who wrote The Fight Club. Okay, so this is like the four of us. I'm not going to go into like the Chuck Palahniuk talk because that was, I mean, it had to do with like, you know, online ratings of prostitutes and stuff. And then, you know, there and I'm like talking, I'm like, I'm like happy, fun romance author. But as it turns out, when I met Diane Mott Davidson, the guy who did the counters in my kitchen had done her kitchen. I was living in Colorado and she was too, and she was like, ugh, I hated him. I killed him off in a book. And so, yeah, I think mystery authors, they have a lot more fun they can do with that. And then, so right there? Yes. So the question is, so with this current series, I went back in time, and have I ever thought about going forward and doing the next generation to look at, like, the kids and grandkids of the Bridgertons into the Victorian age? I would never say never. I mean, I might. It would be kind of fun to see these other characters as protective parents or whatever. It is a little tough because the Victorian times gets into first some, like, really ugly clothing. The early Victorian has, like, really ugly clothes. But, you know, I don't describe the clothes that much anyway, so we might be able to get away without that. And also, but it becomes a much more sort of puritanical society. So I'd have to think about that. I'll be honest, again, as I said, since I'm one of these people who really rarely has more than one idea at a time, I'm just trying to get through this series, and then we'll see what I'm going to do. But I would never say never to that. And then, I know you said one more, but he's had his hand up, so I'm going to... Oh, how do I decide when I'm finally done editing? I'm not necessarily the best person to ask that question to because I don't write drafts the way a lot of authors will go through and they'll whip out a first draft and they'll keep going back. I'm somebody who writes and is constantly editing as I go along. So I'm going to go backwards. So I'm like this, which I need to do it. You just imagine I need to do it. Okay, here we go. I'm like this. So I'm constantly going back a little bit, and then every now and then I go back a lot to sort of see a little more. But what that means, because I'm constantly doing it, is that when I get to the end of the book, I'm pretty much done. So I don't really have a first draft. And so this whole, when do you know you're done editing? When I get to the last chapter, pretty much. And then after that, then I'll do one more pass through to look for like awkward sentences and stuff like that. But I'm pretty much done at that point. And then also, and this again is not, I think, what people want to hear from authors. And I don't mean to impugn the creative process at all. But I also kind of know I'm done when like my editor is calling me up saying like, we need this manuscript right now or you're going to mess up the entire publication schedule. I'm like, okay, here it is. And often that's how we figure it out. So. So, I have no closing words of wisdom. Let's be honest. I guess that if you are an aspiring writer, my biggest piece of advice, if you're writing romances, for example, join Romance Writers of America. It's an incredible writing organization. If you're writing mysteries, look into Mystery Writers of America, but find, you know, a writers association. You'll get so much information about both the craft of writing, but also the business of writing. Because if you're somebody like me who wants their work to be read, whether it's because you'd like to earn a living, which I will say is nice, or because you simply want people to read what you're writing, then it is a business as well. And it's nice to have something to help you learn about how that all works. Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.